The reality of modern automation often doesn't accord with the popular stereotypes we have. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. This is Future Tense. Automation belongs to the factory floor, or the cars of the future, not necessarily to the here and now. For most of us, that is. And yet, automation is all around us, from the go-karts we use for our daily commute, to the coffee machine in the waiting room at the local hospital, even to the algorithm that helps drive and direct our smartphone usage. A few days ago, I chaired a panel discussion at the State Library of Queensland. It was organised by the Digital Media Research Centre at the Queensland University of Technology, QUT. And today, we bring you some of the highlights of that conversation. The guests are Elizabeth Stevens, an Associate Professor in Cultural Studies in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern Cross University, David Bissell, a Senior Lecturer in the Research School of Social Sciences at the ANU, the Australian National University, Jonathan Roberts, a Professor of Robotics at QUT, and Professor Jean Burgess, the Director of the Digital Media Research Centre, also at QUT. Everyday automation is the name of the discussion, and over the next half hour, we'll look at some of the historic, social, and practical aspects. Let's begin with David Bissell from the ANU and his views on whether or not automation has now become the default objective for all government and corporate ventures.
I think that what's fascinating is there are so many different discourses behind automation, the reasons for automating. Very often it's posed around questions of safety. So if we look at applications of robotics in Australia, one of the most prevalent and well-developed is the resources sector and the mines in Western Australia. And the large mining companies have tended to really trumpet the discourses of safety and efficiency in terms of justifying the need to automate mining operations. In other fields, it might be much more around saving time, for example. So we turn to some of the labour-saving aspects of automation in the home, for example, or in the sphere of public transport and of commuting people's everyday journeys, which I think throws up some really kind of interesting questions for me as a critical social scientist. All this time that we're supposedly going to be saving, what are we going to do with that time? You know, is this time that we're going to be given to enjoy more leisure pursuits? Or are we merely automating everyday life, getting rid of some of those menial tasks in order to focus on the higher level activities? You know, I personally don't want to spend my whole day doing higher level activities. I quite enjoy my menial tasks.
You want a bit of a break. I just wonder, though, whether you're talking about the different ways in which automation is described or the need for automation is described. I walked only about a week ago into a store here in this city, and it was about 11:30 in the morning. There was no one on the checkout. It was all automated at that stage. There were lots of people in the store. What's the rationale for that, given that for me to actually process my own transaction, that's taking up my time, it's not saving me time?
Well, I suppose, again, answering as a critical social scientist, the first thing that I would think of is that this is a cost-saving device on behalf of companies very often. Of course, companies come back and they contest that and they say, no, we're actually redeploying staff to more customer-focused roles. That's very often the sorts of discourses that go on there. But I think particularly around customer service roles, it's hard not to be cynical about some of those justifications for removing staff.
Jonathan, you wanted to jump in.
Sometimes the argument for automation is to do things that you can't currently do. So maybe the shop example is a good one, because if they want to open late at night and they currently don't, but they can use some technology, which means they can, then that's often one of the arguments that's used. And there's similar arguments used for a lot of the automation and the robotics that I work in and our labs work in, which is trying to do these things that people are currently struggling to do, or there's a trend where it's getting harder and harder to do things. And examples are things like agriculture, where people are just struggling at the moment to actually perform their farming.
I mean, there are fears, obviously, that people have about automation. You know, we embrace it in lots of ways, but there are fears there. Given, though, that we are so digital, that we like our devices so much, we use them so much, given that even in shopping centres, you don't see people protesting, you see people using these automated tellers, Gene, is that an indication that by and large, as a society, while we have concerns, we are reasonably comfortable with the way in which automation has affected our everyday lives so far?
Yeah, I think so far people are reasonably comfortable with the automated checkout, although you hear anecdotally really interesting examples of people kind of playfully resisting the model by, you know, running the Cavendish bananas through and pretending they're lady fingers, for example. So there's a kind of soft resistance. I think people are very well aware of why it's happening. But speaking of shopping, earlier this week, you know, Amazon Go might be attempting to disrupt that kind of duopoly that we have, at least in Australia, with this absolute frictionless shopping experience where you walk in, you scan an app on your phone, take whatever you want off the shelf and walk out again, and your account is automatically charged. This is made possible through computer vision, lots of data integration, and Amazon's very transparent about that in their excitable launch promo video for that. But of course it raises lots of alarm bells as well, that this isn't even really about providing convenience for consumers, that this is a massive scaling up of kind of retail analytics, which has onward market value in itself.
And in that sense, I mean, just returning to the employment fears that many people have around automation, that isn't just reducing staff, that's basically getting rid of all staff, isn't it? Elizabeth Stevens, bringing you into the conversation, I mean, you're focused on the historical, cultural and social history of robotics. Could I get you to take us back to the second half of the 18th century, which is an area that you've looked at in quite detail, and just tell us about the kind of responses that people had to the arrival of modern automation, if we want to put it that way.
It's interesting because we think a lot of these things are being very new, but in fact the discourse of novelty and innovation is about 250 years old and it begins at the start of the Industrial Revolution. I think, you know, quite often when we talk about these technologies as we are now, we talk about them in terms of automation, of workplace practices and work technologies and what that does to employment and so on. But in fact it's interesting to think that the moment when a lot of these technologies are first in the space in which they're first developed isn't in fact, though, if we look at early industrialization, it's not the factory that is the motor for the development of a lot of these technologies. It's public spectacles, it's public displays, it's spaces of popular entertainment. So, in fact, the first examples of what people now call the first programmable computers or the first robots are actually automata. They're humanoid figures that are designed for popular display, they're designed for amusement. They're technological marvels. They're quite incredible to look at. So one of them, for instance, was the writer, and he's in fact the earliest of these that was said to be a computer or a robot, and he could be programmed to write any phrase at all, just using clockwork mechanisms. One of the most famous of these was he would write, "I think, therefore I am," as a robot. But the same technologies that were used to make these pieces were within about 15 years used to make the first automated looms. It's exactly the same technology. And when the automated loom was implemented in France, the weavers of France realized exactly what Uber drivers and checkout assistants are realizing now, that their industry was disappearing. And so that was the first industrial riots, was people responding to those.
Even back then, there was this kind of the twin thing, wasn't there? There was a kind of suspicion, a fear of where this was all heading. But magnetism as well. I mean, the automata were enormously popular, weren't they? People didn't feel threatened by them in the way that we might perhaps imagine they might have.
There were people who found them quite creepy, even at the time. I mean, there would be some people who thought they were charming and whimsical, but they also looked as though they were breathing, their eyes moved across the room. I'm sure there were people in the 18th century who found them disturbing as well as found them pleasurable. But it's interesting that that tradition of the displays of these sort of technological marvels continues even at the same moment that people are rioting against the same technology being implemented in factories. They are going en masse to the first penny arcades, to the first fun fairs, and engaging with these. So that love-hate relationship you're talking about, you can trace all the way back to the 18th century.
And that follows right through to today. I mean, that is our fear of today, isn't it? And our fascination as well with the sort of technology that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can trace that love-hate relationship the whole way through that history.
And you only have to think about the queues around the block every time a new Apple product is released to get the full picture. Elizabeth Stevens there from the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern Cross University. We also shouldn't forget, of course, that in the modern world, Everyday automation doesn't just involve hardware. There's a software side to it as well. And as Professor Jean Burgess says, that's not always apparent, and for deliberate reasons.
Where I'm interested as a digital media researcher is in where AI is coming together with smartphones and the appification of so much of our everyday life to actually really transform our relationship to the systems that sit behind those things. So we use fitness trackers to help us keep on track of our exercise and weight, but what's going on behind that is ever more interesting to us.
Most of us don't think about that, do we? We don't think about the automated side of that, you know, if we think about the way in which these devices work at all.
And that's very much on purpose. So the holy grail of usability is what's often referred to as transparency, which means actually to make invisible everything that's between you and your objective. It feels like just with a simple gesture, you're matching with a romantic partner, for example. But actually, the more usable and transparent these devices and software become, the more they actually obscure what's going on under the hood and behind the scenes.
And when we do find out what's going on under the hood, sometimes we're quite surprised, aren't we? I mean, I've read several articles in recent times about fake news in the United States and the role that automated bots played in disseminating fake news during the election campaign. So, you know, in that kind of sense, the everyday in that automation isn't necessarily benign either, is it?
Just to take our Facebook news feeds, a lot of people are surprised when they find out that that's not, to use that word again, a transparent representation of everything that their friends have posted, let alone when they find out all the complexities that go into the Facebook news feed algorithm. There was a controversy not long ago about Facebook's trending topics, which, because Facebook seems like the perfect automated system, people assumed were algorithmically generated. So Facebook's algorithms were biasing the news away from right-wing topics. We found out that there were essentially amateur journalists sitting in an office in Facebook somewhere manually generating those topics. Following that controversy, Facebook's recently reintroduced an algorithmic model for generating trending topics because algorithms are obviously more neutral. So I think there's a lot of examples in Facebook around the election with fake news where this tension between actually digital media companies taking on new roles, whether it's urban infrastructure or news gathering and journalism, and the kinds of assumptions about algorithmic neutrality, those things come together, but we're not always aware when things aren't actually automated, when there's actually manual work going on, often very low-paid piecework.
Because of that lack of clarity, that lack of transparency.
Right, the lack of actual transparency.
Professor Jean Burgess from QUT's Digital Media Research Centre. You're listening to Future Tense, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies, the edge of change. I'm Anthony Fennell, and our topic today is automating the everyday. Highlights from a panel discussion recorded recently at the Queensland State Library. As Jonathan Roberts mentioned earlier, automation is continuing to play a huge role in the ongoing transition of agriculture. What's unusual about automation in the farming sector is that it's almost universally seen as a positive. I'll let him explain why.
One thing, because they're used to it through mechanisation. I mean, agriculture over the centuries has changed significantly. You know, there aren't many ox pulling things around Australia now, and there's not many horses left and all those sorts of things. So that community is always very savvy when it comes to adoption of technology. And also, particularly in Australia, the average age of a farm worker is extremely high. As far as I understand it, an average farmer is either in their late 50s or early 60s, and that's going up. So there's a real struggle, and they know it, to, you know, how are they going to continue their farm work? So automation is seen as something that can actually help. We're also seeing it with the introduction of drones, so flying robots. The agricultural community seem to be the early adopters there too. So they've always seemed to adopt this sort of technology first.
How significant is that help from those kind of automated systems? You were telling me before we started about the level of fruit that is actually wasted in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, the horticulture is the classic example where timing is everything, so you've got to get the right number of people to the right farm at the right time to pick the fruit. And there's very high percentages in Australia. I think it's around the high 20s or early 30% of fruit every year just rots on the vine because they just can't get the people there at the right time. It's very difficult. So there's an efficiency thing there.
And the robotics that are being used in the agricultural sector are quite advanced, aren't they? And quite specific. I know I've seen a weed-killing robot which targets very, very small weeds. It's very precise.
Yeah, so we've developed a weed-killing robot, as have other robotics groups. And again, the idea there is it's got to reduce your inputs in farming. So, you know, big input things are things like diesel for machinery and herbicide to kill weeds. It's already been demonstrated you can have a solar-powered weeding robot, so there's no diesel, and you can use that same electrical energy to have some sort of implement that actually hits the weeds and actually hoes them out, just as you would in your garden. And the farmer can, of course, then get on and do other stuff. They don't necessarily just want to sit on a tractor and do this weeding. These robots will actually work at night. The farm goes to bed, the robots get out, they weed the field, the farmer gets up and does all the other stuff they need to do.
On an environmental side of things, there's also another robot that I noticed that you guys have been developing. It's not agriculture related, it's related to the environment, but it's called the Autonomous Starfish Killing Robot.
That's right, yes.
I love the title. Just tell us briefly about that.
So many people are familiar with the crown of thorns starfish, which is on the Great Barrier Reef, and it's doing harm to the Great Barrier Reef, and it's a growing problem. So at the moment, there are certain control measures in place. Bits of the reef have human divers that go down and inject the crown of thorns starfish to kill them, to try and keep the areas under control. We've developed a robot that does that automatically. So that robot has learned what a crown of thorns starfish looks like. So these divers had cameras placed on their injection systems. So over a long period of time, all of that imagery was collected. The robot was trained to say, that's a crown of thorns starfish, that's not. And it's now incredibly accurate. And the robot has now been demonstrated going on the reef, finding the crown of thorns starfish automatically and injecting them automatically and killing them automatically.
And to do that using humans would be enormously, costly, wouldn't it?
It's costly.
Would it be just completely impractical?
Yes, I mean, there's just too much space. Human divers can only, because of health and safety reasons, can only dive for so many hours a day. You know, it's a hazardous occupation. So it's obvious that robots are needed to help the humans there. It's referred to as a force multiplier, fancy term. It means one human, you give them a fleet of robots, they can suddenly multiply their efforts and do a whole lot more.
Jing.
I was just going to ask about the data that's generated as a side effect, or, you know, as an added benefit from that, right? So the system is learning.
Absolutely. And it's monitoring. So this project has, in recent months, won the Google Impact Challenge. And the next phase of this project is actually to develop a larger number of these robots and focus on the monitoring first to get a better handle of, you know, what's happening and where all these crown of thorns starfish are. So that is the next phase.
Roboticist Jonathan Roberts. One of the areas where the notion of everyday automation has really gripped the public imagination in recent years is in the area of transport. Who hasn't yet got the message that in the future, our streets will be full of driverless cars? And as the media and technologists keep telling us, we'll then enter a new blissful era of fewer cars, fewer accidents, and more leisure time. But as our panel attest, things are likely to be much more complicated. Jonathan Roberts again.
The driverless car one's a great example because I think it's probably true in an engineering fact that if suddenly one day all the cars were made driverless, it probably would be safer. But of course, that's never going to happen. There'll be this period of a very long time where there'll be some driverless cars and some human-driven cars, and there'll probably be a lot of accidents because that mix is actually very, very difficult. So there's an idealistic view that you could have everything safer, and maybe one day it will be. Once kind of reality hits people, things tend to be a bit more complicated than the marketing speak.
But that transition period, say if we take driverless cars, and that's really the poster boy of automated systems, I think, at the moment. If you look at that particular area, that transition period is going to be quite extensive, isn't it?
And extremely expensive as well. I mean, you've probably got to modify a lot of the infrastructure. You probably start off with roads that only allow driverless cars on them, and that's an expensive thing. It's a bit like toll tunnels now. is likely that there'll be roads where you can only have driverless cars. I mean, that's going to cost a lot of money because you're sort of locking up infrastructure just for this certain thing. And then I guess it will gradually kind of spread out, but it's not going to be a cheap transition.
And David Bissell, when we're talking about that, then we're talking about rethinking what a city is, isn't it? How it functions.
Absolutely. I mean, people's everyday commutes to and from work are one of the most significant everyday practices that they engage in. And so I think it's no wonder that, as you say, that automatic driverless cars have become something of a kind of poster child for this robotics revolution. Cars are incredibly significant to a lot of people. They're not just something to get from A to B. For a lot of people, they're heavily bound up in their own identity and their own subjectivity. And so this idea where we're suddenly going to be devolving more control to not only vehicles themselves, but the networks that they're enmeshed within, this is going to really change the dynamics of how people actually relate to their vehicles. And related to that, how our journeys to and from work, for example, are more or less pleasurable. You know, a lot of people in my research have talked about how they really enjoy being behind the wheel of a car, even if they're sat in traffic jams. There's something about that kind of relationship of, you know, people talk about control, you know, to simplify, but there's something of a sort of prosthetic relationship between the car and the driver. And of course, when you take that away through driverless activity, then the driver effectively becomes a passenger, which does something really quite different to those power relations. And I think comes back to what was being said a moment ago about the kind of wider power relationship. So a lot of people within my discipline talk about how robotics and AI have generated this, what they call the kinetic elite, this group of people in society who can afford to pay for faster, more privileged access to infrastructures and networks. You've seen it many times before in things like toll roads, for example. But of course, driverless cars potentially intensifies that splintering. People who can afford, if they can afford to, they can pay for their particular vehicle to be prioritized. So you could skip the queues that other people in their own driverless cars can't afford to skip. So this gives rise to potentially new inequalities.
And we've already seen, haven't we, with Uber, a very successful company, we've already seen surge pricing come to the fore. When we talk about driverless cars, I mean, we're talking about them being developed by, I know Apple's recently announced that they're involved, Google, all sorts of other technology companies. We're not talking about government. So we're talking about private enterprises who will want to make a profit one way or another.
I entirely agree. What is fascinating, though, about driverless cars, again, coming back to that question of time and temporality, what does having a driverless car enable us to do? What are the new capacities that it gives to us as commuters, for example? You know, does this free up time that we want to spend doing something else? How are our car environments going to change beyond the idea of propulsion? How could we rethink our pod environments? You know, could we actually be really creative here and turn them into zones that we spend time with friends and family, into kind of, I don't know, mini drinking dens? You know, the options are limitless.
So there's opportunities there. I mean, people do already work on the train, don't they? You know, people spend an hour commuting in the train. You know, some people tell me they get a lot of work done that way. So that there are opportunities there. Are those kind of conversations occurring, though? Those sort of social conversations, are they being matched with these technological conversations about the mechanics of doing all of this?
Look, I mean, I think it's interesting the sorts of, yeah, exactly as you say, the conversations that are going on around these sorts of technologies, and even just the sorts of words that we use to describe these new technologies, you know, revolutionary. Suddenly, even just calling a technology revolutionary gives it an allure that that it wouldn't have if we described it as, you know, incremental change, or this technology is intensely familiar. And so I think that even the ways that we're actually constructing these futures in our present, in the way that we're talking about them, in the sorts of words that we're using. We referred earlier to the Amazon Go promo clip this week, and I watched it and I thought, wow, that's beautiful. And it was partly because of the aesthetics. You know, the music was sort of gently lilting, the voice was reassuring. There's a really aesthetic element in the way that we're actually constructing and envisaging our futures that play a really powerful role in the creation of those futures.
And there are a lot of assumptions that are put out there by companies, aren't there, Jonathan? I mean, again, talking about automated cars, there is an assumption that's put out there and usually isn't questioned by the media or by, you know, other people looking at this area, that an era of automated cars will necessarily mean fewer cars on the road, that we will all suddenly be happy to share, to not own a car, Well, we can already do that, can't we? We can use taxis or public transport. We choose not to do that. Most cars on the road these days that you see, I know as I'm driving into work, have still one person in the car as they're driving in. Why would moving to an automated system change those kind of human habits?
Well, it might change from a generational point of view. I mean, as far as I understand it, fewer young people are getting driving licences now in Australia. So there's already the beginnings of a shift where young people don't think it's as important as they used to drive. My son, for example, gets Ubers all the time, and so do all his friends. I guess it comes out to the business case. So is it going to be significantly cheaper and, you know, more convenient? I think if something is cheap and convenient, then it may win in the long run. If something's convenient but expensive, probably won't win.
It wasn't so long ago that, you know, if you asked these kind of questions or you talked about this side of things with technology, that you were dismissed, you know, or held down in some cases. But do you think that we're at a stage now where people are willing to have a more nuanced conversation about not just the good that technology is bringing, but where we need to start seeing perhaps parameters?
Yeah, I think the popularity of particularly, you know, entertainment programs that are asking serious questions about the division between the human and AI, the ethics of AI, I think are testament to the fact that as a society generally, we're really interested, engaged, puzzled, concerned and anxious, frankly, about these things.
And as I often point out to people, we're only just at the beginning, aren't we? Yes, automation's been around since the 18th century, but the level of automation within our society is quite extraordinary and it's quite recent, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's coming in areas that people don't even realise. I sort of have a lot of fun with my students at university when we do the first computer vision course, that I point out to them that probably every grain of rice that they've consumed that week has been looked at by a robot. Because the reason everyone gets these packets of rice with all the same colour rice, all of about the same size, is because a robot sorts that rice. You know, rice doesn't grow that uniformly in the ground. It's not some magic. It's because a robot sorts it out. It sorts it into all the little white ones there, the slightly longer white ones there, the slightly yellow ones there, and they're all then used in different things, and it all looks very uniform. So a robot is touching and seeing everybody's food all of the time. No one has a clue. Yeah. Like, no one's got any idea.
So picking up on the conversation we've been having, in a way, the world has been changing, and we're really kind of at a point where many of us are just discovering our world, aren't we? This is new to us, that these intricate systems, these complicated, very efficient systems can operate. Gene?
From the mid-18th century, as Elizabeth pointed out, but certainly since the Second World War, we're always in a state of agitation and excitement about what we call the perpetually proximate future. Things are coming, things are happening. And many of those fantasies we have about perfect leisure time and socialising in our driverless cars have been around since the 1940s. You know, it doesn't take long on Google image search to find some pretty fantastic retro sci-fi images about the space age. We still don't have flying cars, though.
No, I think that's a business case thing. It's expensive to fight gravity. So when you fight gravity, it costs you more money than not fighting gravity.
Now, that's not what any of us want to hear. Professor Jonathan Roberts bursting our futuristic bubble there. Driverless maybe, but certainly earthbound it seems. We were also joined today by Gene Burgess, Elizabeth Stevens and David Bissell. Automating the Everyday was the name of that panel discussion, and thanks to the Digital Media Research Centre at the Queensland University of Technology. This was the final in the 2016 series of Future Tense. Over the next 5 weeks, some of our highlight programs from the past year. But we'll be back again with a whole new season of the show come late January. Thanks to Julie Burley, who does our transcripts, and to sound engineers Peter McMurray and Steve Fieldhouse. Thanks also to my co-producer, Karen Savanovitz. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time.